now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello, I'm Alison Rudd and I'm joined by an octa-busting panel. Rory Smith is in the studio and down the line we have Ollie Kay and James Ducker. Before we begin, a reminder that you can see all the goals and the rest of the highlights from every Premier League game before anyone else simply by downloading the Times app to your smartphone. We will be discussing events at Old Trafford, why Michael Laudrup was sacked, and whether standing areas could safely be introduced in the Championship. But first, it's all change at the top of the table after Liverpool scythed their way through a bickering Arsenal to win 5-1. After going four ahead inside the opening 20 minutes.
Well, Arsenal endured their worst first half in the Premier League for 13 years, and it could get worse in the second. Here is Sterling. Chesney makes the save. Sterling again. 5-0 to Liverpool. And any hope of an improbable Arsenal revival has just been snuffed out.
Steven Gerrard, he said, "We have absolutely demolished a team from start to finish. That was as explosive as it gets." Ollie Kay, is he right?
He is. Well, I suppose you could argue it wasn't from start to finish because there was so much damage done in the first 90 minutes that they only needed to score one more after that. But it was as good a performance, I would say, as anything I've seen in the Premier League this season. And there have been some very, very good performances, notably from, I suppose, Manchester City in particular, but Liverpool have suddenly got this knack of absolutely blowing teams away and scoring goals in fours and fives and great football, breakneck pace, attacking with such flair and invention and finishing so clinically at times that I think it really was up there. I mean, Gerrard said he felt it was one of the top three performances in his time as a Liverpool player, and I would agree with that. I was there when they beat Real Madrid 4-0, was it? And I think that probably stands out as the best in my mind from the Benitez era. But they are doing this an awful lot to teams at the moment.
I mean, Ollie doesn't sound too surprised that Liverpool were so attacking and so good. In that case, why didn't Arsenal set up more defensively or to counter-attack or just take into account the fact that they were going to be on the receiving end?
Well, it looked to me, I mean, like Rodgers had really, really, really thought through his game plan and how best to sort of exploit Arsenal, and he obviously, I think he shifted Suarez, didn't he, out to the right to go up against Monreal, and Arsenal, by contrast, it looked like quite a flimsy game plan. But then when you have so many players and, you know, your leading players underperforming to that extent, maybe no game plan would have worked. I think they often say, don't they, when you need it, eight of your 11 players to be on top of the game in the big matches, particularly against an opponent that is on fire. And I mean, Arsenal had, you know, a couple of players, if that, who were average. Everyone else was lamentable. So you cannot legislate as a manager for so many players going missing. And in Arteta, Ozil, Wilshere, Cazorla, Giroud were just all diabolical.
I don't know to what extent Wenger ever really has a game plan. Like that sounds more critical than it needs to, but he doesn't really change his system to fit his opponents. He doesn't really sort of do anything different at home or away. To an extent, it's a strength that his team plays the way that his team plays, regardless of the opposition. And that's often the hallmark of a great side, that they just do what they do and other teams can't cope with it. But I think there are occasions where you maybe need to be a little bit more subtle than that and a little bit more canny. And that might be why Wenger has a comparatively poor record against his fellow title rivals, and in a lot of kind of substantial Champions League games, certainly after the kind of golden era of Henri and Vieira and all that.
So do you think, Rory, that Wenger would not have looked at the tapes of the way Aston Villa contained Liverpool and then ignored it?
I'm sure he would, and I'm sure there will have been some attempt to try to, you know, to work out, to advise his players how to deal with Suarez and Sturridge and Sterling. But I don't think it didn't look like. It's hard to tell when a game changes in the first minute. It's impossible to know what his intentions would have been. He might have planned to park the bus, but obviously that goes out the window as soon as you concede to Sturtle. But I very rarely see Wenger try and change the way Arsenal play, particularly.
The blueprint for him really was the City game. I mean, the sort of closest team this season that we have to sort of Man City in terms of a fast-flowing, fluid sort of front six who interchange and sort of press with great intensity are Liverpool. You know, I mean, they have sort of, you know, swatted, brushed teams aside. I think that was the eighth game this season that they've scored four goals or more, and really only City sort of compare this season to that. So, you know, and it was literally almost a carbon copy of the game at the Etihad, where Arsenal's sort of defenders in sort of midfield were just absolutely swarmed, and it was almost like Rodgers studied that game intently and thought, "I've got the players, I've got the front six here who can do exactly that job, and I'll go for it." And I think Monreal played against City in that 6-3.
Yeah,
I think it was one of his first games back, and he was absolutely abject. Honestly, it was one of the most pitiful performances I've seen from a player, even worse than Andre Santos at Old Trafford a season or two ago. In that sense, sort of going back to your point, Alison, Wenger looked like he'd learned no lessons whatsoever from that beating at the Etihad, and I bet Rodgers almost couldn't believe what he was seeing when he saw that. When he saw Monreal at left back.
The other thing that should be mentioned is that it shows how important Flamini is to Arsenal. I mean, I know that everyone said it at the start of the season, isn't it great, what a canny move by Wenger bringing him back. But that was the problem, that there was just nobody. I mean, I like Arteta, I quite like Wilshere. I'm not sure Wilshere's a great central midfielder in a game like that, but they need that bite, that tactical intelligence that Flamini has, and it was just completely lacking. It looked like the Arsenal of kind of the start of last season, the start of the season before that as well, that Arsenal with no backbone, with no sort of intelligent player just sitting there and directing play. They look completely directionless.
Ollie, I mean, James mentions not learning from the game at the Etihad. Is this defeat from Arsenal's point of view more significant than the 6-3 thrashing at City?
Well, that defeat at City didn't end up feeling that significant, because they went on a very good run after that and got back to the top of the league, and they were there till Saturday. I think this feels more significant because they've now got a pretty tough run of games. I was going to say after Man United on Wednesday. No, they've got Man United on Wednesday. They've got Liverpool in the Cup. They've got Bayern home and away. They've got other tough games. And I think everybody had already pinpointed this as the point in the season where Arsenal are really going to have a test of their mettle. And this is not, you know, this was not a good way to start it by any means. And we haven't even touched on, well, I think James mentioned him, but Ozil looked like he was not engaged in the game whatsoever. He looked like a waste of a shirt.
But this isn't, this. A lot of people are saying this was a performance from Ozil which is just on the trajectory of how he's been performing.
He started well,
and with each game he's got just perceptibly a little less involved each time. I mean, what, anyone got any ideas why this would be?
Castorino says in the paper today that, and it's a beautifully written piece, that Ozil looks like he thinks he's doing Arsenal a favour being there, and you do get that impression a little bit.
But you can think a team is lucky to have you and still want to prove that they are.
Yeah, when Ozil came, there was a lot of, I think he had a huge psychological importance, and he's obviously a brilliant footballer. Neither of those two things are up for debate. But if you look at what happened in Spain last year, he didn't often last 90 minutes, because Mourinho felt that he didn't have that, I guess, the fitness, the intensity over the course of a game to really influence things. He tended to take him off after about an hour. He's just the player you want when everything's clicking and you're roaring forward and you need someone to find little bits of space and little clever passes. But Mesut, I don't think Mesut Ozil would say that he's you know, the one that you want in the trenches with you when things are going wrong. I don't think he'd pretend to be that player. But there is a question mark, I think, over, yeah, it's not even the last few weeks. It's kind of the last 3 or 4 months, to be honest.
Yes.
You get a little bit fooled because every touch that he takes is so perfect and his control is so flawless and his technique is amazing. You think he is playing well. I think a lot of the time he looks like he's playing well. I'm not sure how much damage he always does.
James, can Wenger drop him? What would that mean to morale? Given that everyone seems to have concluded that by signing him in the first place, it boosted Arsenal's self-belief.
If he's playing poorly, then, you know, his price tag and that terrific sort of early start he had shouldn't come into it. You know, Wenger's got to play the players that he thinks are most in form and that are going to be most suited to that particular game. And at the moment, Ozil's performance don't necessarily warrant the sort of inclusion. Where the issue is how would he react to that? Is he the sort of player who would respond positively, or is he the sort of player that would sulk and not take it particularly well and not respond like Wenger would hope he does? I think in Europe against Bayern Munich, you know, it might be more like his game, but they've got some very tough sort of league games coming up, and you do sort of wonder whether he might benefit from a brief spell on the sidelines.
Ollie, moving on to Liverpool, should they be aiming higher than fourth?
When you are fourth and when you're playing as well as that, I think it's natural to start raising your sights and aim higher than that. I mean, what is it? Are they 6 points off the top?
Yeah.
I mean, we could all laugh at Mourinho when he says about Chelsea being a little horse and how they can't possibly challenge for the title now. I mean, they have not been used to challenging the last few seasons. The fact is, though, that neither of Arsenal, all but one season, have Manchester City, really. So Liverpool are the team who have come from a much, much lower base over the last two seasons. I mean, they've been a seventh, eighth team, a team that sort of wins about sort of 40% of their games over the last few seasons, or three, four seasons. And suddenly they are playing at a level and scoring goals at a rate and performing so well that it is legitimate to ask that question about can they win it?
There will come a point if they do stay sort of 5 or 6 points behind, where they have to say, look, they've got a decent run in. It's not an easy run in because the flip side to having all the top 10 at home is that you've got all the bottom 10 away, which when things come to the crunch is not what you want. You don't want to be playing relegation threatened teams in April at their place. But yeah, I mean, if City sort of stumble a little bit, if this is Arsenal trying to regress into the mean, then it's possible. But I can see why Rodgers is saying, let's just get fourth. That wasn't even the target for the season. The target was Champions League football within 3 years. So he's ahead of schedule. So I think it's important to manage expectations to an extent. But at the same time, I refuse to believe that the players aren't looking at that and thinking, well, actually, do you know what? We are only 6 points off the top. We might as well go for it. Just try and win every game you play and see what happens.
Yeah. Finally, on that match, James, if I were Roy Hodgson, I would definitely be taking Raheem Sterling to Brazil with me. He's got lightning pace, and you know, I do think that's the thing you need more than any other when you're playing in that sort of tournament. People are scared to tackle him.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, sheer pace like that can be devastating when sort of harnessed properly. And you know, he had an electrifying start to his Liverpool career, and then there's a few sort of off-field issues, and he's four. Maybe it all went to his head a little bit, and he took his form, certainly took a nosedive. But he's really, really come back. He's really come back strongly. He was very impressive at the Etihad over Christmas, and he sort of really kicked on from there. And it does help. I think, playing a team with Coutinho and Suarez in it. You know, England don't have players like that, and he'd certainly have to adjust to that.
Rory, what is the feeling that Sterling has overcome his mental frailties?
Yeah, Rodgers has sort of referred to that a couple of times, that maybe the second part of the season last season was difficult for him because of the contract issue, and because maybe he'd had a little bit too much too quickly. But he does seem to have buckled down a little bit. He's got rid of the stupid haircuts. And there does seem to be a renewed kind of vigour and professionalism almost to his performances. And I think that's natural for a teenager. He was 17 when he came through. He's always been dressed up as this big hope. So it's probably natural there would come a point where maybe he did start to believe his own hype a little bit and his performances dropped, but he does seem to be over it.
Launch long by John Arnarisa. Vidic with a header. Oh, Michael Carrick, oblivious to the fact that Sidwell was coming in from behind him. It's Kieran Richardson. Saved by De Gea. Bent. 2-2. And in the fourth minute of stoppage time, Fulham have salvaged an equaliser to break Manchester United hearts.
Fulham travelled to Manchester with a wild and wacky plan, a puzzling team sheet and the look of relegation fodder. But then their new signing, William Kvist, revealed before kick-off that Rennie Meulensteen had a, I quote, superb plan. Well, it was superb, wasn't it, Rory?
It was, yeah. I really enjoyed Mike Phelan's description of it as being a good plan that was working and then it stopped working and then it was working again. Thought that was fantastic insight from the man who's been manager of Manchester United for the last 5 years. That was what teams used to do at Old Trafford, and they normally got battered, but Fulham showed that they were dogged, they were intelligent, they played to United's, what United think are their strengths but are actually their weaknesses. They allowed Manchester United to cross the ball 81 times at a central defender who was 6'7". And I mean, to be honest, Meulensteen kind of said that United played into their hands with their predictability. Huge credit for Fulham. I'm not sure it's enough to save them, but huge credit for that performance.
It wasn't a superb plan, though, was it?
No, it was going all out defensive.
Yeah, I mean, it was a plan helped enormously by the predictability of United's attacks. I certainly agree with Meulensteen in that sense. But had more than 18 of the 81 crosses found a teammate, then I suspect Fulham would have had a lot more trouble dealing with those crosses. But there was a lot of issues in United's performance, and you know, it did raise Meulensteen, even though he may have an axe to grind, was right to sort of question Moyes' tactics. But there was a large element of luck, I think, involved in that result. As much in the end as they sort of did deserve a point, and as equally lamentable as United's defending was in times, I think they had like four attacks, Fulham, and they scored from two of them. They should have scored from another.
Do you remember when Chelsea beat Barca? What was it? No, when they drew with Barca in the Nou Camp, 2-2. And I remember the next day, everyone sort of said, "Oh, what a great defensive performance!" He said, "I think, well, fine, they got through, great result, but it can't be. It's not a great defensive performance if you concede twice. That's not a great defensive performance. That's conceding twice." It was the same yesterday. Meulensteen says, "Yeah, it was really predictable. Why did they let United score twice then? If it was that predictable, then United wouldn't have scored twice. If it was that easy to defend against, then United would have got none. Surely." Sorry, that just annoyed me.
I would say credit to Dan Byrne in particular. I'd never seen him play before, and thought that selection in particular was quite bizarre. He'd only played three Premier League games before, and I thought he was superb. But if you're 6'6" or 6'7" or whatever he was, I mean, it must have been a delight to find United not only just crossing the ball endlessly, but crossing it to the head of a guy who's 6'6", 6'7". I mean, there was no way. I mean, I'd love to see how many of those crosses were delivered above shoulder height and how many of those balls United won at that height. Because if you've got Rooney, you've got Van Persie, you've got Mata coming in from one wing, and you're not going to win headers.
Isn't it slightly pathetic that United just kept doing the same thing? I mean, James, you sound like you've got some sympathy for Moyes, and that they were unlucky.
No. I was trying to stress before that was that you couldn't describe Fulham's plan as a superb plan. That's not to say for a minute that I thought Moyes' tactics were correct. Quite the opposite, actually. It seems that Juan Mata has been signed to become the new Antonio Valencia. I mean, I was quite critical after the Stoke defeat, when he was played pretty much as an orthodox right winger, as to what is the point of spending £37 million in a play if that's going to be your plan. I cannot for the life of me understand how he is not starting games with Mata, Januzaj and Rooney as a compact three behind Van Persie, and letting them interchange and be fluid, which is exactly the sort of qualities that they have. Instead, we have a situation whereby you've got one winger hugging the left touchline, you've got one makeshift winger who's actually a sort of a central attacking player hugging the right touchline, and balls are just being sort of pinged into the middle, and you've got Wayne Rooney increasingly isolated, not just because of the wingers, but because the midfield sits so deep on the manager's instruction. He needs to be playing those best players week in, week out.
You two were both there. I've only seen the sort of clip from the press conference where he sort of said that crossing the ball is part of United's DNA. And James, you wrote last week, and this is the best phrase I've heard to sum up United's problem, is that Moyes is somewhere between delusion and defiance in terms of his kind of point of view and the way that he thinks United seem to be playing. But do you get the impression that he knows that they are predictable?
No, this is the I think this is what is a great concern to United supporters, is there seems to be times when he thinks that they've played very well, but they've not got a result, or they've narrowly lost. I mean, by what sort of standard is he judging Man United sort of performances? I mean, one can only imagine sort of an Everton standard when they were really, really struggling, as opposed to sort of finishing fourth. It does seem to be quite predictable for the most part. Get it out wide. There's very little play through the middle. I mean, one thing he might say is that until I get the sort of central midfielders in, it's going to be difficult to play the way I want to. But I don't think anyone sort of sees signs of how what Moyes' blueprint is, what his plan for the future is. I mean, if we go back to Brendan Rodgers, obviously it has taken some time for him to get to this stage. But right from the start, it was quite clear that there was a certain way he wanted his team to play. And yes, there'd be very bad days at the office, there'd be some good days, but he wouldn't deviate from the plan that he wants. No one really knows what they're supposed to be doing, and the problem is the players themselves don't really seem to know what they're doing. We've had a situation with the two central midfielders sitting very, very deep, and basically in recent weeks it's sort of been relayed to Moyes that it's just not working. It's leaving Rooney far too isolated, or whoever's playing in that hole, particularly as the wingers are hugging the touchline. So there has been some sort of change. He has tried to push a midfielder further on, but what is the sort of end game here? What's the strategy?
So, Ollie, how do you think Moyes will react to the drop points against Fulham? I mean, it's 18 points dropped at home now. When does it start that he proves that he's got some tactical nous and the ability to impose his personality on the team and say that wasn't good enough, we're going to do it differently? Do you think he will?
I expect he will look at that performance as one that was good in most respects, but extremely weak in both penalty areas, which I think is probably true in a way, but it's that kind of match where a manager would normally turn around and say, look how many crosses we've put in, look how many shots we had, look how much possession we had, look how few times they even crossed the halfway line, as if that is going to be, as if that is a real defence of his team. I mean, I thought it was pretty indefensible that they failed to win that game. If that had been a training ground exercise where you'd been playing.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Against that Fulham back four for 90 minutes with you know, pretty much total possession and put that many crosses in and get sort of created so few chances and converted so few chances and somehow contrived to concede two goals to a team that barely had the ball, I think that's pretty lamentable in many ways. And I think Moyes can choose to look at it whichever way he wants. I think the defiant way would be to talk about the positives, but I think he will. I mean, he used that. He mentioned that thing about softness, which I totally agree with. They look like a team that's got no backbone.
Ollie, there's one thing I have to clear up with you. Did you subcontract your marks out of 10 for the players? Because it says in the Times on Monday morning that you've given Steve Sidwell 7 out of 10. I'd have given him 10. I'm confused.
Well, what did he do? I mean, look, he scored a brilliant goal. He won the ball very well for the second goal, but I barely saw him in between. He wasn't like he was really.
I think you were just looking at United. I don't think you were looking at Fulham.
No, I wasn't. I just was seeing one team with the ball and one team without it.
He did not stop. He did not stop running. He was tackling. He was creative. He was the heartbeat. And you look, that team sheet was the most gobsmacking team sheet I have ever seen and saw before kickoff and thought, oh my goodness, what the hell is going on there? There were debutants galore. There were players who barely proved themselves and have looked rubbish for Fulham. He's mangled them all together. You don't know what formation it's going to be, and it's stuck together because of Steve Sidwell, who I would consider taking to Brazil. I know no one's going to agree with me, but I think he's been the one bright spot for Fulham all season, and it came to the fore yesterday.
7 out of 10 is very good in the Times.
You gave Dan Burn an 8, Heitinger an 8. Annoyed me, Ollie. It's only 1 point. What does it mean for Fulham?
I'm not sure. I think we're at the stage now at the bottom where you probably have to look at the fixtures to work it. They're all basically as bad as each other. I think Swansea have got a little bit more than the others, but the bottom 10 who are separate, it's not quite as close as it used to be at the bottom, because I think Fulham now 4 points, 3 or 4 points off safety. There's a little bit of a gap opened up. I think the bottom 10 are all as bad as each other. They're basically interchangeable. So you look at who's got what fixtures. Like Norwich's last four are Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea and City, I think. Or not City, United. Which means that the chances of Norwich getting more than 3 points against Manchester United from those last four games are pretty slim. So that means that Norwich are now playing with what? What's my maths? 9 games to get the points that they need to stay up. So you'd automatically start to fear for them. I've not seen Fulham's fixture list. You need to go through it. But I think...
Fulham, Rory, have got Liverpool, Chelsea, City and Everton in four of the next 7 games.
That's not ideal.
No.
I think that it's that stage of the season now where you have to look at... You've got all these teams who are basically the same. They're all as bad as each other. You look at who they're playing and then the ones who've got the toughest fixtures will go down.
Oh, that seems a bit clinical.
Well, you know...
Where's the romance
There's
in
no
that,
room for
Rory?
Art or beauty or romance, Alison.
Does anyone think Fulham could possibly stay up? James?
I wouldn't like to say anyone categorically is going to go down or not. We've seen in recent seasons some utterly sort of bonkers results in the final 8 weeks of a Premier League campaign, and so anything is possible. I certainly wouldn't say they are definitely going to go down. It's going to be very, very tough, and given those fixtures that I've just suggested, is the next, you know, the next. Well, the remainder of this month and most of March, you know, should define them. There is a danger they could get cut adrift. But
that said, you'd rather have those fixtures in February and March than in April and May.
Yes, that's true. Fulham's, I'm just looking at the fixtures there. Last 7 or 8 games are winnable. You know, Villa, Norwich, Spurs, Hull, Stoke, Palace.
And the thing is, there's so many teams down there. James is right that there is a possibility if you lose all of those games that they've got coming up, then you could be 7 or 8 points off. But there's so many teams down there that as long as you can stay in touch, there'll always be ones from above who start dropping down when they have harder fixtures. So, I mean, it could well be that we go into the last couple of games of the season with 8 or 9 who can still go down.
Yeah.
But it'll be decided by who's got the toughest run of games and when.
Right, time for a debate. Michael Laudrup guided Swansea to their first piece of significant silverware when he won the League Cup last year. But as he was planning for the Europa League game against Napoli, he was sacked. So was this a reasonable response to Swansea's loss of form or a panic move? I can't quite get my head round the words Swansea have sacked Michael Laudrup. Anyway, while I try and cope with that, Ollie, was this inevitable? There was a lot of talk, wasn't there, about Laudrup probably not staying after the summer anyway. So was it pragmatic? Was it reasonable? Was it a travesty? What was it?
I would say of those three, it was pragmatic and reasonable. I'm normally one who sort of shakes my head in disgust when a manager gets sacked, or often anyway. But he was going to leave at the end of the season. I think that was pretty well accepted.
So why not let him stay and win the Europa League for Swansea?
They'd been poor for a couple of months. There were an awful lot of tensions behind the scenes, not only between himself and players, but there was a sense that things weren't going well on the training ground, that his training wasn't working. And also, you know, there'd been rows about Laudrup being sort of fairly dismissive of what was needed in the transfer market in January. And I interviewed Laudrup early last season, loved him as a player, and really wanted to buy into this vision of Laudrup, the genius manager who makes everything look effortless. But everything I've heard from out of Swansea over the last 6 to 12 months, you know, almost ever since the League Cup final, has been of a team sort of on the drift.
To sort of an outsider who, you know, just sort of, you know, pays sort of passing attention to Swansea, I can understand that it would be a very, very difficult decision to rationalise. And in some cases, people would maybe consider it inexplicable. They just see, you know, Laudrup coming in, winning the League Cup, you know, continuing this sort of model of very attractive, sort of expansive football. When really the picture sort of behind the scenes was very, very different. I certainly wouldn't liken it to the same extent as the situation of Roberto Mancini at Manchester City, where behind the scenes it really did get ugly. The murmurings and what was being said was there were some similarities to the sort of, you know, the early warning signs that developed at City under Mancini. And I think you know, Swansea have proven that they're not a knee jerk club that make rash decisions. They have a sound sort of ownership structure. They generally are very supportive of the managers and believe in their way. And for them to sort of make that decision, they won't have taken it lightly, but they will have been concerned enough to make it, you know, for the sort of the future benefit of the club. One thing that being put to me about Laudrup was that he was just very. He did not take well to recommendations about maybe we could improve this in this way, and not someone forcing something on him saying we have to do it this way, we have to do it that way. Just generally recommendations about maybe we need to think about something in this way.
The obvious parallel to me, Rory, doesn't seem to be City so much as Spurs. I mean, you've got two teams hoping to do well in Europe, and you've dispensed with a distant European-style manager and you bring in someone who's already there and claims to know the players much better and shows more passion and does things in a more sort of join-the-dots sort of way. And so Gary Monk is sort of the new Tim Sherwood. Is that a reasonable parallel to draw?
Yeah, well, the temptation is always to look at any decision made within English football and assume that the problem that's been identified is that whoever is at fault isn't shouting enough. Mm-hmm. And neither Laudrup nor Villas-Boas were shouters.
Exactly.
And I think that's probably a fatal flaw for both, and they should both look in their time off to learn how to shout at greater volume and in greater frequency. I think, well, look, you speak to people at Swansea about Monk, they really rate him. They think that there is something there. We know that Levy liked Sherwood and has always liked Sherwood, but Levy's behaviour in giving Sherwood the job didn't indicate that he's got any great faith in him. He wants to see how he'll do,
Yep. But
he's not certain that it'll work out. Whereas Swansea are going to do everything they can to make sure that Monk does work. They want him to succeed.
He's further along in his UEFA badges, isn't he?
Well, that's very important. No, he is, and they've been grooming him for this job. That's a weird verb to use, but they've been grooming him for this job for ages. And they really. I spoke to Ashley Williams about him after the derby, and he said that he can see little sort of traits of Martinez, little traits of Rodgers. Monk's had a great coaching education. There's three people to work with: Martinez, Rodgers, and Laudrup. Mm. That's not a bad background to have. William said they're doing similar kind of training exercises, sessions that he recognises, that he remembers from Martinez and Rodgers. Swansea want Monk to succeed. They think they've got something special there. and they think that he can start this kind of horrible cliche, but this boot room philosophy at the club, which they're really keen to introduce, to see people organically introduced into management rather than appointing kind of random outsiders. As they did with Laudrup, it was a good appointment, it worked. I think you have to look at across the whole piece and say that Laudrup was a success at Swansea. He'll put it at the top of his CV. It won't be buried down with personal interests. But they want to have that kind of thing where they can bring their own managers through and they can continue the philosophy. And they see Munch as being the first step in that. And also, and this is important, he looks like Steve the Pirate from Dodgeball.
Oh, he looks like him.
He
right.
does, yeah. Looks okay. exactly like him.
Just on Laudrup as well, Alison. You know, if you actually look at his relatively short managerial career, you know, he spent very little time at clubs. You know, a year at Getafe or so, a year or so at Spartak Moscow, similar time at Mallorca. I mean, you know, he's a bit of a nomad, really, already.
I think the thing with Laudrup is that he comes in and he does have, like Ollie also know this from interviewing him, he has an aura, like you. Ollie has that similar aura, and he sort of comes into a room and like, wow, that's Ollie Kay. But Laudrup is charismatic. There's people who know him say that he's maybe in personal situations, he's quite sort of shy and a little bit awkward. But he is a charismatic figure, especially to footballers. And he comes into clubs and he gives players their head. He basically says, look, I trust you, do what you like. He treats them as adults. There's no kind of regimented kind of, you've got to do this, this and this. It's all very relaxed. It's all very laid back. And that works really well initially because players respond to it. And it's not the same after Rodgers, because obviously Rodgers isn't some sort of sergeant major. But he goes into a club where maybe the players have had a more dictatorial manager and they really respond to that freedom. But the problem is that when things go really well, as they did at Swansea, the players maybe start to take advantage. And when things start to go badly, as they also did at Swansea, the players then blame that, despite the fact that that same approach has worked gloriously. As soon as things go wrong, because players will seek excuses for anything, because it's never their fault, they will blame the fact, oh, the managers know there's no discipline. So the trip to Dubai, which came out in the papers last week as being some sort of indisciplined rabble, the players loved at the time. They had a really good time. They thought it was a brilliant bonding exercise. But now they say, well, actually, no, that was no. He didn't give us a curfew. You're grown men. Why do you need a curfew?
But James, he's a nomad partly, I think, also because he doesn't adapt. He doesn't want to be told to change. He has his way of doing things. And he doesn't like he finds it almost insulting, I think, that if results go badly that you automatically are told as the manager will change something because he believes in what he believes. And after the West Ham game, which was the last post-match interview he gave, and I was there, and he rambled on about how it is impossible for individuals to change the way they are. And he was ostensibly talking about Chico Flores and his theatrical personality. But in fact, he could have been just talking about himself, really. That he was saying, I don't, you know, you can't tell someone behave differently, you are what you are. And the Swansea management hierarchy, they said, well, we don't want you to be what you are anymore. We're going to debate something else this week in more depth than a quick hit. We're going to look at the fact that the government has agreed to discuss permitting standing at championship grounds after Football League clubs voted in favour of a change in the law. And it seems most Premier League clubs, I think 19 out of 20, in fact, are roughly in favour of a change as well. This, of course, is in the context of the fact that the Hillsborough Family Support Group opposes any plans to allow standing at football matches and is writing to all clubs to ask them not to pursue this. This is, I think, a difficult issue, but it seems to me very peculiar as we approach the 25th anniversary of the Hillsborough tragedy for this to become an issue in football, and it could well happen unless people like the Hillsborough Family Support Group remind everyone why we're in this situation to begin with. I am against going back in time and introducing standing. I know it was fun to stand, but I think, you know, we've grown used to not doing so at big grounds where there's a lot of people in there. Why even risk it? Why bother devising special seats that retract and are supposedly safe? I personally don't think it's something that the game desperately needs in order to grow and succeed. It's doing perfectly well without it. Rory, are you equivocal on this, though?
Yeah, I'm torn. I can understand. You look at Germany and it does work. There's no problem with safe standing in Germany, so it can be done safely. I don't think that introducing standing areas again is the same as going back to the problems that caused Hillsborough and that made football in the 80s such an insane an unsafe experience. I think there are ways of doing it so that it's handled more sensibly, more intelligently. I think Tony Barrett wrote a good piece on this, sort of saying that just because one disaster happens doesn't mean that you have to rule out. You can at least have a conversation about it. But at the same time, I completely understand the Hillsborough family's message. I understand Liverpool's stance on it. They're the one club that has said they're not prepared to talk about it. They will do whatever the families advise them to do. Whatever the families think, that's what Liverpool will follow. So I don't think there'll be any safe standing at Anfield. Whatever happens, I don't think that's on the cards. I can see why the clubs want the atmosphere benefit that it brings. You'd like to think it might bring prices down, which might help kind of stop the game's rampant gentrification. I think that there are powerful arguments on both sides, and yeah, to be honest, I don't have a.
If you had to, gun to your head, you have to say one way or the other. What would you say?
I'd say, why is someone putting a gun to my head? I think it should be investigated, because I don't think that just because one bad thing happens, one terrible thing happens, means that you have to necessarily put a blanket ban on something, on that kind of activity. Because it wasn't just standing that caused Hillsborough. As we know from the long fight for justice, there were other issues at play. And it's a really emotive, sensitive subject, and it's difficult to kind of to be coherent and as coherent on it as you like. I think it's worth having the conversation to explore if there is a way of making it work so that what happened at Hillsborough can never happen again, but that some of the benefits of standing can be retained.
James, why is this something that football needs? Why do we have to open it up and talk about it and think of ways of going back to standing? Why does football need this?
Rory and Ollie, you know, touched on two points there. I think atmosphere at grounds, I'm generally obviously restricted to sort of the Premier League these days, but I do think the atmosphere at grounds needs to fill it, needs a boost. And similarly, I do think standing areas would result in a drop in prices, and football is becoming extremely expensive. It's become sort of a middle to middle upper class of sport.
Oh, but in fact, James, the fact you say that to me, that implies, as if, you know, I'm exaggerating on purpose, that it seems to me you're saying, maybe there can be sections of grounds where tickets are cheap and you can cram people in and it becomes a more unpleasant experience, and you're paying less money so that it's less gentrified.
That's
a
huge leap, Alison, from what I was saying.
I know it is. I'm just stirring it.
One thing I would say is I agree with the sort of the 25th anniversary of Hillsborough coming up. The timing, to me, is odd. But sort of going forward, I think there needs to be a thorough discussion of it. As Rory said, I think it needs to be investigated thoroughly. And it needs to be determined as to whether it's workable.
It's hard to think of an appropriate kind of parallel. After the Challenger disaster, NASA didn't stop exploring space; they just made it safer. And is that not the same principle that?
We've done that. We've made it safer to be at a top flight ground.
Yeah, no, much safer, and it's been of huge benefit. And I think you're right; it has changed the culture of the match day experience in the Premier League, and largely 99% in the Championship. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you should that it has to stop there. I guess that if there is a way of standing that is safe, that can rid the game of the risks of another Hillsborough happening, which is obviously the last thing anybody wants, then it is worth exploring. If you find that you can't do that, if you can't guarantee people safety, then you've had the conversation and you stop the conversation.
Right, I've denied you, gentlemen, the hit that comes with those quick-fire questions at the end. So I'm going to let you, if you so wish, raise any other business very quickly. If there's one thing that has really bugged you over the weekend that you feel you have to tell me about, I'll tell you one thing. Interviewed Peter Cech after the game at Stamford Bridge, and I asked him, because it's quite hard to get Peter Cech to get fired up, so I said, go on, player gets a hat-trick. What happens if you're a player and you've got a hat-trick? You know, what do you do? Do you make them buy them cream cakes? No, you just keep the ball and the players sign the ball. I would quite like there to be some more traditions in the dressing room at Premier League grounds where if something nice happens, like you score a hat-trick, you have to buy cream cakes or something.
I've got one. At the South Wales Derby on Saturday, there was just one of Cardiff's Norwegian contingent, three strong Norwegian contingent on the bench, Mats Møller-Dahle, Magnus Volvikram, and the other one, Joanna Burdett, weren't there. They weren't in the matchday squad. I find that odd.
I know it's a. Daniel Sturridge's goal celebration. I try to put it at the back of my mind, but I see him and you just want to slap him, don't you? I mean, it's almost like he stood there thinking, how can I make myself just look really, really unlikable and really, really annoying.
That goal celebration is a reason not to take Sturridge to Brazil.
Absolutely. It's just, you watch that absolute masterclass and there's just so much to admire. And then it's ruined by a goal celebration so bad in just, oh God, it's just this, he's just so pleased with himself. It's just absolutely nauseating to witness.
I saw a thing that was tweeted about from Liverpool's programme on Saturday where it had a question and answer with Luis Suarez. It said, I look at it now, last time he laughed out loud, his answer, when I was sitting on the bench during the derby, one of the lads said something funny and we were laughing. That's like one of those boring Milner tweets, isn't it? James Milner parody. It's what happened to dressing room humour and sort of that humour being sort of rammed down people's throats in a slightly annoying way rather than just.
Well, what happened to it was quotas, wasn't it? How many Spaniards are allowed to sit next to each other? How many Italians? Scots?
Ollie, do you know who the wag is on the Liverpool bench? Who's the funniest player at Liverpool? Do you think it's Luis Alberto? I bet he's hilarious.
Yeah.
Maybe Times readers will now know how hard it is to extract a decent anecdote of detail from a footballer in this day and age.
Next week, we'll be chatting about the weekend's FA Cup action and the rematch between City and Chelsea and the small matter of Arsenal seeking revenge against Liverpool. Thank you to Oliver Kay, Rory Smith and James Ducker for the big talk, chaps, and to all of you for listening. I'm Alison Rudd. Goodbye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification and you're away.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.